Tonight I'm going to talk about development of the mind, or mental development, if you like. This, in a sense, this idea of developing the mind is one of the Buddha's discoveries. He understood that it's possible to do such a thing as developing the mind. And you may think, of course it's possible. But in fact, it's not as obvious as you might think that this actually can be done. And I will talk about that maybe towards the end of the talk, why it is not so obvious. But the first thing is just basically that mental development is a wonderful, wonderful discovery here. Because so many people spend all their lives trying to develop their happiness, trying to develop their contentment, trying to develop their lives, always by external things, always by earning more money, by social position, by possessions, by all these kind of things. This is normally the things that we try to develop in our lives. And very few people actually spend enough time working instead directly on the mind, instead of always trying to find satisfaction and happiness indirectly using external things. And if you think about it, if you're really going to be happy, it is much wiser to do it directly by working on the mind rather than trying to gain that happiness through external stimuli indirectly. First of all, it's much more efficient because you're working directly with the source of things. And secondly, if you're working on the mind rather than having an indirect happiness, you can actually change the mind directly, which you never can by external things, by using possessions or fame or whatever else it is. That way you don't actually change your mind, you're just giving the mind a stimulus which makes it happy for a very short period of time. So working directly on the mind is a much wiser, much more far-reaching, and much more powerful tool that we can use in life. And the Buddha said that it's possible to develop the mind. This can be done. He said that if it wasn't possible to develop the mind, I wouldn't give these teachings. It is because it's possible, because it can be done, that I teach Dhamma in the way that I do. It's possible to develop wholesome states of mind. It's possible to develop a luminous mind, a beautiful mind, a peaceful mind. And it's possible to get rid of all these negative tendencies that we have inside of us. And it's precisely because it's possible that I teach the way I do. I give this teaching to you. And I have to admit, in my own life as a monk, a Buddhist monk, certainly the idea of mental development is one of the draw cards for being a Buddhist monk. The more highly you value the idea of developing the mind, well, the more obvious it makes sense to become a Buddhist monk or a Buddhist nun, for that matter. Why? Because that is the whole focus of the monastic life. That is the whole purpose of monastic life. You're giving up most of the other external things to give 100% attention to the development of the mind instead. So what is it about monastic life? I'm going to talk a little bit about monastic life first of all, and talk about lay life afterwards, how these same principles that apply to monastic life also apply to lay life. So what is it about monastic life that makes mental development so much more possible, if you like, or much more efficient in monastic life than it is in lay life? And there's two things in particular I want to talk about. Now, the first one is, of course, the idea of kalyana mitta, of spiritual friendship. This is a very important aspect of monastic life. If you think about it, when you live as a monk, you are surrounded by other monks all the time. You're always reminded when you see another monk, you think, yeah, I'm also a monk, I'm also part of this. You always, when you talk to your fellow monks, you tend to talk about Dhamma. Not always, but often the conversation is about Dhamma, because that's what all of you are doing together here. So you're always reminded, you are in the middle of the Dhamma all your life. And because of that, of course, you have much more inclination yourself to also practice this Dhamma, because you're part of a group of people, everybody practicing in the same way. That's the first thing. The second thing is, of course, that you have the kalyanamitta is not only the people you're surrounding you with, but one very important factor of the spiritual friendship, the kalyanamitta, is the teacher that you have. It's extremely important to have a good teacher. And ideally, the kind of teacher you have is somebody who has a full appreciation of the Buddha's teachings, who has insight into those teachings that the Buddha gave 2,500 years ago. So this is one of the things, if you can find a good monastery, a good place that has a teacher, which has that sort of insight, it is wonderful because you come into the presence of the living Dhamma, the living teaching of the Buddha, as he gave it 2,500 years ago. Because it is those people today who realize those teachings, they are the living example that it's still possible to practice those teachings 2,500 years after the Buddha. So this is one of the wonderful, wonderful things. It's great to have books, of course, about Buddhism and read what the Buddha said. This is very important. But sometimes if you only have the books and you don't actually have the living example, it's as if something is missing. It's like the moisture is missing or something is not there, which should be there. It's only when it comes alive in actual people that you see around you. When you see somebody in your life who you find inspiring, when you see somebody who lives up to the example of the Buddha's teaching, that when it becomes really real. And certainly for me, that is extremely important. So that is the second aspect of monastic life, is that you come close to these kind of teachers. Ideally, you live with a teacher who has these kind of qualities. And you then become conditioned, you become influenced. And slowly but surely, you're moving in the same way. But the highest kind of spiritual friendship that you can have in monastic life, and this of course also true for lay life, is the friendship of the Buddha himself. In that friendship of the Buddha himself, you gain by reading what the Buddha said 2,500 years ago. When you read what the Buddha said 2,500 years ago, you're in the presence of the Buddha. There he is right there. Because this is what he was. This is what he was all about, teaching these teachings. So there you have the highest kind of spiritual friendships right there, right in front of you, by reading these Buddhist teachings. And it's actually quite important to have some idea what the Buddha talked about, because if you don't know that, it's very easy to be led astray. You have no idea what people like me, I come up here and speak to you, you don't know what I'm saying. You know if it's true, if it's wrong, if I'm leading you astray. The only way you can find out if what I say is correct or not is by going to the suttas and check it out. Am I saying what is in accordance with the Buddha, or am I talking nonsense? And of course you can't take my word for that. You have to check it out for yourself. And it's important, and I know that there are many people who have been led astray by teachers in the past, and when they find out that the teacher is not what they thought this teacher was, they become incredibly disappointed. And sometimes they fall away from Buddhism, they fall away from this potential of developing themselves in a beautiful way, simply because they placed faith in the wrong person. So for that reason, it's good to have some idea what the Buddha taught. And the Buddha is the highest kind of spiritual friend because, of course, he had the full insight into the teachings that he taught. So don't neglect that. And of course, in monastic life, you have these things more than you have anywhere else. I spend a fair amount of my time as a monk to study these suttas. I study these suttas almost every day because I think it is very important to know what they are. And it's also very nice to be able to draw inspiration by reading some of these beautiful teachings. So these are the reasons why, one reason why I'm a monk, for the spiritual friendship, because it pushes you along. It gives you this extra impetus on the path. And sometimes people think, oh, I don't need the spiritual community around me because I'm really solid, I'm an individual, I know what is right and wrong in the world, I can do it all myself. I'm not so dependent on the spiritual community here. But the fact is, and this is one of the problems, we tend to overestimate our own independence. We tend to overestimate our sense of individuality, that we can go against the stream of the world, go against what everybody else is doing, and do things our own way. The reality is we can't do that. The reason we can't do that is because we are 100% conditioned as human beings. We are conditioned by the people around us, by the things we hear, the things we see, the things we read, and we don't have anywhere near as much independence as we think we have. And this is the reality of this teaching of anatta, of non-self in Buddhism. Because there is nothing permanent inside of us, because there is no like entity which controls us and steers us in the right direction, because that is missing, we are essentially just conditioned, and we are running around according to our conditions. It's only because we have this illusion inside of us, this idea that we are some kind of separate entity, we get this feeling that we are in charge, we are in control. Well, we're not. And because of that, it is so important to have a spiritual community around you. And that is as true for lay people as it is in monastic life. Obviously, in monastic life, it is more powerful and more easy to get. So that is the first part of monastic life, which I value so much, this idea of spiritual friendship. The other aspect of monastic life, which is very beautiful, is the idea of seclusion, that you can withdraw from society, you can withdraw from the world around you, you can withdraw from all these things, and just be by yourself, be completely self-sufficient in your little cootie in the forest, far, far away. Why is seclusion so important? Why is it so useful for practicing the spiritual path? How does seclusion lead to mental development? What is actually going on here? And the first thing, of course, is simply that when you are secluded, you are away from the noises of the world, all the traffic, the people, the everyday things which are happening in the world all the time, all the noise and the problems. That, of course, is a very big help in its own right. The second reason, which is also an important one, and this came up quite recently, there was a young woman who came to me and asked if she could interview me, because she was doing some kind of research, anthropological research project at one of the universities here in Western Australia. And she asked me, well, how do monks view the city? What is the monk's view of the city? She was trying to figure out something about monks and city. I must admit, I wasn't sure what to say straight away, but then I realized that probably the way the monks view the city is the city is the realm of sensual desires, the realm of sensual delights, because that is what people do in the city. They run around, they enjoy themselves, they go and see, get entertained somewhere, they go to the cafes and restaurants to eat nice food, they go and see nice sights, they have a nice park to walk in, they may do courtship with somebody of the opposite sex, or they may just make lots of money, try to make more money for themselves and get status and get social position, all these kind of things. So the city is essentially about sensual desires. And this is the other thing about monastic life. You get away from the sensual desires, because sensual desires are the opposite of peace of mind. They're the opposite of meditation, the opposite of being able to develop your mind in the right direction. And that is probably the main reason why the city is not the place to be if you're going to be really serious about practicing spiritual path of Buddhism. And to give you some ideas how highly the Buddha praised the idea of seclusion, the idea of pulling away, because I always take my references from the Buddha himself, because he is the ultimate teacher in this whole thing. There's a beautiful little story in the Buddha's discourses. These discourses are called suttas, in case you don't know. In these suttas, there's a beautiful story of the Buddha wandering around in India with a large retinue, a large group of monks with him. At a certain point, they pass by a village, and on the outskirts of this village, they see another monk. And this monk is sitting on the outskirts of this village in meditation, and he looks very straight and looks very impressive. And they walk past and they see this monk. Later on, they walk through the forest. And as they're walking through the forest, they see another monk. And this monk is obviously tired, or he has sloth and torpor, because he's nodding as he's meditating in the forest. Something is not quite right in his mind. And then, having seen these two things, the Buddha then turns to his monks and he says, first of all, did you see that monk on the outskirts of the village, sitting there in meditation, in samadhi or whatever? And the monks say, yes, Lord, we saw that monk at the outskirts of the village. And then the Buddha says, quite surprisingly, because this monk was meditating properly, surprisingly he says, I am not happy with that monk. Why am I not happy with that monk? Because he's sitting too close to the village, and before you know it, he's going to be disturbed by somebody. Somebody's going to come up to him and say, excuse me, why are you sitting here? Or something like that. That's what often happens. And then the Buddha said, but did you see the other monk who was sitting in the forest? And he was nodding. And again, surprisingly, the Buddha says, I praise that monk. That monk is praiseworthy. Why? Because he's sitting far away from the village, far away from the city, it will only be a matter of time before he overcomes that tiredness, before he overcomes the sloth and torpor. And then his meditation will be going really well because he's far away from the world, far away from the city, far away from people. Now this gives you some idea of the degree to which the Buddha praised seclusion and solitude. Another story which comes to mind, or rather it came to mind when I was thinking about what I was going to say tonight. And this is a story where a layperson comes to the Buddha, and this layperson asks the Buddha, who should we place faith in the world? There are all these monks out there, all these nuns, all these people. Where should we have respect? Who should we respect? Who should we support? Where should we place our confidence and faith? And the Buddha answered that the place where you should have respect, the place where you should support, are those people, those monks, monastics, nuns, whatever it is, who are in the forest, who meditate in the forest, who are far away from the world. Because it is among those monks and nuns that you will find those who gain the deepest meditation, who gain the deepest understanding of the Buddha's teachings. That's where you're going to find it. Why? Because they are far away from sensuality. They're far away from the troubles and sensuality of the world. That's why you're going to find it there. But for those who live in the village, or those who live in the city, well, those monks, there's a great chance that they will be affected by their surroundings. And for that reason, it's much, much more difficult for those people to let go of sensuality, let go of sensual pleasures. Of course, this doesn't mean that every monastic who lives in the forest is going to be a supreme example of enlightenment. Of course not. All it means is that you're much more likely to find those good monks, those good nuns, or even good lay people sometimes that come to stay in faraway places. That's where you're going to find these people who have attained these things, who have understood the depth of the Buddha's teachings. Sometimes, of course, this is not true. Sometimes you can find a very good monk in a city or a village. It's just a general principle that the Buddha laid down. So these are some important guides for you to see why seclusion is so important, because you get away from sensuality. There's another simile which the Buddha used, and this is a simile of the fire stick. A fire stick in ancient times, the way they made fire was by having two pieces of wood, and they would rub these pieces of wood together, and by rubbing the fire sticks together, they would produce sparks, and in this way, eventually, they would produce a fire. This is the way it was done a long time ago. And the Buddha similarly, he says that it is just like a fire stick which is lying in water, a wet and sappy fire stick lying in a puddle somewhere. There is no chance that you're going to be able to use that fire stick to make a fire. Why not? Because it's wet and sappy. And it's just like somebody who lives in the city or a village, because they are surrounded by sensuality, because they themselves enjoy sensuality and are full of sensuality, there is no way that they are going to get the fire. The fire here is a metaphor for meditation. They can't get that meditation, because they are living in the middle of the wet sensuality of the city. Then the Buddha says there's another type of fire stick. This is the fire stick which lies far away from the river. This is like somebody has gone to the forest somewhere far away. But it's still wet and sappy. Wetness and sappiness here means there's still sensuality in the mind. In other words, it's possible to live in a monastery far away and still have a mind full of sensual thoughts and sensual ideas. And of course, again, it is useless. This fire stick, you cannot use it to make fire, because there's no way you can get something that is wet and sappy to make a fire. In the same way, it doesn't help you just to go and live in a monastery. You have to actually abandon these sensual parts of the mind as much as possible if you're going to have success in a meditation practice. And of course, the only fire stick which is useful to make fire is the one which lives far away from the river, in other words, far away from sensuality, and is also dry and sappy inside. You have dried out the sensuality of the mind. You have dried out the sensual pleasures. And all you have left then, you have a mind, you have a stick which can make fire. And then it is possible for you to gain deep meditation. So this is then the requisites, what you have to do And that this is how the monastic life works. First of all, you go to a secluded place far away to get away from the sensuality surrounding you. And then the second part of the practice is to remove the sensuality in the mind. And then you have a chance to really go deep in your meditation practice. So this is why the monastic life is so useful. And this is why the monastic life you read about, for example, in Thailand, which always is the most famous of the Tai Chi teachers, they always lived in the forest. They always lived far away from the city. Because this is a traditional way that monks and nuns have always lived since the time of the Buddha. Because it is the way to gain deep meditation. It is the way to do it, basically. So how does this affect our life as lay Buddhist? What can you do as lay Buddhist? Of course, it is not easy for a lay person to find the kind of seclusion you find in the monastery. It is also not easy for a lay person, lay Buddhist, to find the kind of spiritual friendship that you find in the monastery. But it means what it means in lay life, spiritual friendship, is still very important because it is the foundation condition which is going to make the spiritual life possible just as much in lay life as it is in monastic life. So have some joy, have some sense of happiness that there is such a thing as a Buddhist society in Western Australia. A place you can go to find like-minded people around you. It's very important to have like-minded people in life because we are so conditioned by the people around us. There is so much social pressure in life. I know how hard it is to give up drinking, for example, if everybody around you drinks. It's extremely difficult. Sometimes I tell my younger brother that you should stop all this drinking business because it's not going to do any good. But all his friends drink, you know. So what can I say? I can't really tell him to go against what everybody else does. It's very hard to give up these kind of things. So don't underestimate the power of having a place like the Buddha Society, having these kind of people around you who are like-minded, who think in the same way, who do the same kind of things. Search these people out. Make sure that you have these kind of friends because it's going to be a tremendous support in your life as a layperson to have these kind of people around you. Don't underestimate that. Remember what I said before about the Buddha's teaching of non-self. There's nobody in here. There's nobody controlling all of this. There's nobody who is always able to withstand the pressures from outside. And because there is nobody who is able to withstand all these pressures, because there's nobody who is able to hold on to these things, it's incredibly important to make sure that the external conditions condition you in the right way, that push you in the right way. This is why it is so important. So it's a wonderful thing to have so many friends, so many potential friends in the Buddha society. Don't underestimate the power of that. Make sure you socialize with that sort of people. Make sure you use them, don't abuse them, but use them to your best of your ability so that you can actually benefit from that spiritual friendship, that Kalyanamitta. And of course, the other thing is that you also have a chance of coming here to listen to talks, and this is your chance to hear the Buddha's teachings by coming to the Buddha site. Again, it's a wonderful and amazing thing. I don't think sometimes people quite understand that a place like the Buddha site in Western Australia, how rare it is in the world. You travel around the world and you don't see places like this almost anywhere else. My own home country is in Northern Europe, Norway, far away. And sometimes I go back there and I think it is so backward, this place, compared to Western Australia. Or even you go to places like Sydney, much larger city than Perth, and yet the Buddhist scene in Sydney is nowhere near, doesn't have anywhere near the kind of quality and cohesion as you find in Western Australia. And this is what you see again and again around the world. Almost wherever you travel, particularly in the West, it's very difficult to find good spiritual friendship, the real Kalyanamitas. So value this opportunity. Value the ability to come here and listen to talks, to be around people like Ajahn Brahm, people who have a deep understanding of these teachings, all these other teachers who come here and give you the teachings. It's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. And then watch those teachers and see if they live up to the standards that the Buddha said they should live up to. And then lastly, you also lay people also, sometimes if you have the chance, read a little bit of the Buddha's teachings. There are some very good books available now, introductory books, which get you started. Because again, as I said before, the Buddha, he is the ultimate spiritual friend. That is where you find the the ultimate reference for what Buddhism really is all about. And that is when you can decide for yourself what real Buddhism actually is. So this is the Kalyanamitta in lay life. Make sure that you take advantage of the opportunity of Kalyanamittas around you. Of course, there's also the internet these days, and the internet is a wonderful, wonderful thing. The Buddha Society has quite a good website, I understand. I don't really know very much about these things, but I understand it's quite good compared to other Buddhist websites. And the wonderful thing is that it allows people around the world. I've heard about people who live in the middle of like Christian communities, or sometimes fundamentalist Christian communities, but they are Buddhists. They have no spiritual friends whatsoever. There's nobody to support them. But they have the virtual community of the internet. They can log on and they can hear a good Dhamma talk. So it's a great thing. It's a wonderful investment, I think, that the Buddha Society has done to provide this service for thousands of people around the world who don't have any good spiritual friends. So this is one of the great benefits and the beautiful things of using modern technology to provide spiritual friendship far, far away. It's an excellent thing, I think, that we're doing here in the Buddhist Society. So that is the spiritual friendship. What about seclusion in lay life? How should we approach seclusion? And there's a story, again, from the suttas, where one of the Buddha's main supporters, a man known as Anathapindika, he was probably the main supporter of the Buddha. He gave vast fortunes to the Sangha to build monasteries in particular. And he once went to the Buddha, and the Buddha gave him a teaching, and he said to Anathapindika, "You also, Anathapindika, you also, and lay people, you should also sometimes get away from the city, get away from the hustle and bustle of life, and enjoy the happiness that comes from seclusion. The happiness that comes from the seclusion is the happiness of the mind, the happiness that you get from meditation practice." So the Buddha said that every one of you here, if you are eager about spiritual practice, sometimes take the opportunity to go away, do something, go somewhere peaceful, go somewhere far away from the ordinary pleasures, the hustle and bustle of life, and do a meditation retreat, for example. It's a wonderful thing that the Buddha Society now is building, a meditation retreat center. I'm sure all of you have heard about this meditation retreat center, just across from Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine. It's a beautiful meditation center, very peaceful surroundings, just like being in a monastery, really, the same kind of surroundings. So if you have the opportunity, use that meditation center in the future. It's a wonderful and great resource. I think it's probably difficult to find anywhere else in the world that has such a wonderful meditation retreat center as the Buddha Society has here. So make use of that resource. The Buddha said we should make use of this kind of resource. So this is the kind of seclusion that you can get also in lay life. Make sure you do that from time to time to test out how you're going, to test out if you're making progress, to test out if that mind is being developed in the way that it should be. So all of these things are support for developing the mind. If you have that spiritual friendship, if you have that seclusion, then developing of the mind is going to happen. It's going to happen much faster than it's otherwise going to do. So that was going back to where I started. I said I became a monk largely because of being able to live in a monastic setting. I chose that because I realized the many benefits, I think, at least in part. I've realized those benefits much more after becoming a monk, actually, than initially. But that was one of my decisions because I knew that was going to be beneficial for developing the mind. And developing the mind made such incredibly good sense to me here. When I looked around the world, I realized that it's the happiness of the mind which really matters in life. The happiness that comes from material things is not so important. You can travel to some of the poorest countries in the world, and sometimes you see people happy. They have beautiful smiles on their faces, even though they're absolutely dirt poor. So that was one decision I made, and it is interesting that all the decisions that you have to make can make in life, all the choices that you have to make or can make, these can always be made according to a very simple rule of thumb. And this is the kind of rule which I want to just mention briefly here. We recently, just yesterday, we had a monk in Bodhinyana Monastery who left for Sri Lanka. And every time somebody leaves the monastery, I think to myself, why should one leave the monastery? What is the reason? What is the right time to leave a place and go somewhere else? Sometimes I myself have thought about, should I go somewhere else? Should I start a monastery somewhere? I was recently invited to start a monastery, actually. And the more I think about it, the more I think, well, maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't. But what actually criteria should I use to decide this? And the Buddha gave a very simple rule of thumb to decide if a monk or a nun or anybody should go somewhere else. He said that if you are improving in wholesome qualities, if your mind is developing in mindfulness, if your meditation is becoming better, if you're becoming more concentrated, if you are reducing in the unwholesome aspects of life, then you should stay where you are. You should not go anywhere else. The Buddha went so far as to say, even if they ask you to leave this monastery, you should not go. You should still hold on to this place. I remember some years ago we had a monk staying at Bodhinyana Monastery. He said, even if I'm told to leave, I will chain myself to the front gate of the monastery here because this is really working for me here. And he was right. It was the right thing to say because the Buddha said, you can refuse to leave if things are going really well for you here. Of course, maybe there comes a point when you have to leave because it becomes too difficult, but you can at least try to refuse initially here. And when you should leave a monastery is when you are deteriorating here. When you're getting more unwholesome qualities coming up, more anger, more desire, more jealousy, your meditation is deteriorating, your mindfulness is getting worse, your wisdom is deteriorating, that is when you should leave the monastery. The Buddha said you should leave that very same day because it's pointless to stay in a place where things are going down. Why? Because the whole purpose of life is to increase the wholesome qualities of the mind. This is what it's all about. This is the whole point of this. If you are missing the whole point of this life, then of course you have to do something else. You have to leave. You have to go to a different place. So this is the criteria by which you should judge whether you should go somewhere or not go somewhere. Are things going right for you? Are you increasing in the wholesome? Are you becoming more happy, more contented, more satisfied? Is your mind becoming brighter? Are you getting more wisdom? Are you getting more compassion and kindness for the world around you? What do you feel inside of you? Do you feel better? If you do, then you should stay put where you are because things are going somewhere else. Of course, the grass tends to look greener on the other side of the fence. So you have to be very careful not to just jump over the fence just because it looks greener. If we're doing well already, stay where you are. Don't move on. And the Buddha said, this is not only for deciding where you should live or whether you should move or not. This is also about deciding anything in monastic life. What sort of food should you eat? What sort of robe should you wear? What sort of hut should you live in? All these choices in life, almost anything you choose, should always be guided by whether it will increase the wholesome in you or it will increase the unwholesome. That is the general guiding principle. It's a very simple way of making decisions. It's a beautiful way of being able to make decisions in life. And you can, of course, apply that also to lay life. This is not something that only applies to monastic life. How do you apply that in lay life? Well, in lay life, sometimes I think we tend to forget. We tend to sort of sometimes put the spiritual life is like in one pigeonhole, and then our worldly life is in a different pigeonhole. But we have to be sure that we try to integrate the spiritual life into our worldly life. It's very important to make our worldly life spiritual in a certain sense. So when we make our ordinary life more spiritual, then when we have to make a choice in life, particularly the really large, the really important choices, make sure you try to give those choices a spiritual factor. Give it a spiritual, one of the components, one of the things that you use to decide things in your life. Make sure spirituality, how you can develop your mind, make that part of the choices in daily life. So for example, if you think that maybe you should move houses, you want to go somewhere else, maybe a place you think is nicer, maybe you think you're moving overseas or interstate or whatever, then ask yourself, what effect is this going to have on your spiritual life? Are you going to be able to have a good spiritual community around you? Remind yourself of the importance of a good spiritual community. Are you going to find that there? Is it going to be as good as it is where you're staying now? Or is it not? Make that at least one factor. It is not wrong, of course, to travel overseas or interstate or changing houses or whatever. There's nothing wrong with that. But try to bring the spiritual aspect into the equation, to broaden your scope of view a little bit when you decide on these kind of issues. I know people who have moved close here to the Buddhist society in Dolamara to have easy access to this place. And I think that's a wonderful thing to do, because you are showing, in a sense, that you are very dedicated to the Buddhist path. And it gives you a chance to increase your practice of Buddhism. What are the choices in life? Choices about careers, for example. Maybe you get a possibility of getting a new job with much better salary, with better status, higher up in the hierarchy of a company. Should you accept that job or should you not? Well, again, there is no right or wrong answer. It's not as if you should always say yes or always should no. The point is more that make the spiritual aspect one of the aspects in making that decision for yourself. Should I accept a job or should I not? If you think that accepting a job with more responsibility, with higher salary, is going to make you more stressed out, it's going to make you more... And when you get stressed, maybe your temper gets more short, or maybe you start saying bad things to people around you. Well, then maybe you should have second thoughts. What is really important in life? Is it my spiritual progress, the fact that I can actually do something with my mind, change my mind, develop the mind, or are the worldly things more important to me? Add this to the equation of your life. And then ask yourself, you might alter things a little bit. You might look at things slightly different. Maybe you will decide it's not really worthwhile taking on lots of responsibility, which might be very stressful and might have a detrimental effect on my life, my spiritual life. So again, I'm not saying this because I say that there is a right or wrong answer in these things. Just make this part of the equation. The last thing I was thinking about, which is very important in people's lives, particularly when you are young, people think, well, should we have children or not? And how many children should we have? Again, ask yourself again, it's a question of, again, there is no right or wrong answers. But that, of course, again, the spiritual life, put that also into the equation in deciding if you should have children, and if so, how many you should have. So these are some ways of using the spiritual guide to make decisions in life. And you can actually use this idea of what is going to be good for your spiritual life in almost any kind of decision that you take in life. So you try to do this, because it might change your perspective slightly, might change your way of looking at things slightly from what they otherwise would be. You may come to some interesting results in life if you do that. So these things are just a few things to help you give you support in mental development. I want to talk briefly about what mental development, how we actually do it in more practical things. I'm not going to talk very much about this, because mental development is really just about the Eightfold Path. Practicing all the Buddhist practices that we talk about normally, that is what mental development is all about. But just very briefly, mental development usually can be divided into three aspects. You have the virtue aspect, the morality, if you like, then you have the meditation aspect, and then you have the wisdom aspect. These are the three aspects of developing the mind. And you will find that all of these three aspects, ultimately, they come down to the development of the mind. If you practice virtue, what is happening if you are a good person, if you're a moral person? If you want to be a moral person, sometimes you have to restrain yourself from doing things that you otherwise might do. You have to stop maybe saying something that you might want to say to somebody, because you know it doesn't fit with the moral code as it's prescribed by the Buddha. So you restrain yourself, and the restraint, of course, happens in the mind. So it is the mind which develops when you are virtuous. Or you decide to be kind, you decide to say something nice to somebody that maybe otherwise you would not. And again, of course, that impetus, that intention, comes from the mind, even though it actually is a verbal act. So ultimately, all morality also is a mental thing, and that's why it counts as a development of the mind. As you are being virtuous, as you're being kind, you start feeling better about yourself. You don't have any remorse anymore. You create a sense of beauty inside of you. And because there is no sense of remorse, there's less darkness in the mind, less grayness in the mind, you start to feel lighter. You feel more beautiful. You feel more radiant inside of you. You feel a sense that the mind is becoming more beautiful. And you can see this happening if you're able to sustain that virtuous practice over a long period of time. And essentially, the main thing here is that you're taking away remorse. You may think that you don't have any remorse after doing something bad, but very often what happens is that the remorse we often have is a very kind of subtle thing. You may not even be able to see it inside of your mind, but it's almost as if the mind gets slightly darker or slightly more gloomy because we have done something negative. And you may not even be aware of it yourself. But the Buddha said that if you are virtuous, you take away that remorse. And that's why the mind, slowly but surely, stage by stage, becomes more radiant, more peaceful, more kind, more compassionate, as you practice that virtue. So virtue is mental development. Being moral is the development of the mind. And of course, meditation then takes that mental development even further, because then you are working directly with the mind itself. But in life in general, and this is true both for monastic life and also for lay life, the most important aspect in all these trainings is always the aspect of virtue. This is so important in life, because this is like the foundation stone. If you can be virtuous, if you can be good, then you are laying the foundation stone for meditation to happen. You almost don't have to meditate at all. If you are in lay life, very often people don't have so much time for meditation, and it's okay. Very often people think that meditation is the essence of the Buddhist path, so what I should really do more than anything else is meditate. And I would say, no, what you should really do more than anything else is to make sure that you live a kind and good life, a moral life, kindness towards others, goodness towards others. That should be the main priority in all life, whether monastic or lay. Because when you do that, you're creating the mind which will be able to meditate. If you don't do it, you can meditate as much as you want, but you will never get there because you haven't laid down the foundation work. That is how important it is to have a virtuous and moral life. It's the only way that you're going to be able to have a stable and good meditation in the future. So this is where your focus should be. This is the main focus in developing the mind as far as I'm concerned. And then if you do some meditation in daily life, ask yourself, how can I use this meditation to support my practice of virtue and morality? If virtue and morality is so important, what sort of meditation will support that? And of course, you can do a little bit of compassion, a little bit of metta meditation, so that you when you have the metta inside of you, it's so much easier to be kind and to be moral and to be good to the people around you. So it's a very powerful way of helping your virtue, helping your morality. Or you can just do a little bit of peace meditation, because again, if you feel peaceful, if you have a sense of tranquility inside of you, if you feel good about yourself, it's so much easier to be kind and good to the world around you. So that, I think, should be the main purpose of meditation practice. Use it as a support for your virtue, for your kindness in daily life. And then if occasionally you have a deep meditation, that's wonderful and that's great. But sometimes it's difficult to get that really deep meditation in lay life. If you cannot get it, don't be too concerned about it. Use it instead just a little bit to get that sense of feeling better about yourself, to make it easier to be kind to the world around you. So this is the power and the importance of virtue. And this is the most important part of mental development. Then, when you have a chance to go on retreat, maybe you have a chance to go to the new meditation retreat center in Serpentine, then you can test yourself and see how far your meditation, your virtue practice of virtue has gone, and see if it has an effect on your meditation practice. And then maybe, if your meditation is going well, then maybe you can even start developing the wisdom aspect, the panya aspect of meditation, or rather, I should say, of development of the mind. Because then, when your meditation is going well, that is when wisdom has a real chance to arise in the mind. So this then is what we mean essentially by development or developing the mind. These are the three kind of characteristics. And when you develop this, again, what you see inside of yourself happening is you become more peaceful stage by stage, slowly, slowly. You become a more peaceful person. You become more contented. You become more satisfied with life. You get more self-esteem. You get more self-confidence. You feel better about yourself. All these things that we want in life, they come from this kind of development of the mind. And of course, it's wonderful when that happens. And you should observe yourself, look at yourself as you do this practice, and see if this sort of development actually is happening. If you look inside of yourself and you see the development is not happening, nothing is going on, then you should ask yourself, what am I doing wrong? What is not happening? What is not going right? Maybe there's some adjustment I can do to my practice to sort things out so I get more mental development out of this. And when you evaluate yourself in this way, and it's very important to evaluate yourself, for goodness sake, don't evaluate just from a day-to-day basis, not from week-to-week basis. Evaluate yourself from month-to-month, from year-to-year. Take a very long-term approach, because these things take a while before they actually have an effect on the mind. So don't be impatient. Don't think that it isn't working just because you haven't got results straight away. Allow it to take time, and then evaluate yourself over periods of time, long periods of time. And then you will see whether your practice is actually working. You have to be patient in this practice. Patience is extraordinarily important as well. So I want to go back to where I started off on this talk. At the very beginning, I said that this is one of the most wonderful discoveries of the Buddha, that there is such a thing as development of the mind. And I always ask myself, sometimes I wonder, I look around the world and I say to myself, why is it that not everybody practices development of the mind? Why is it that so many people are trapped in this idea that their happiness is going to come from outside, through relationships, through wealth, through possessions, through all these kind of things? Yes, there is happiness to be gained in those things. But the real happiness, the true happiness, comes from developing the mind. It doesn't matter how wealthy you are, it doesn't matter what sort of relationship you are. If you are depressed, you're going to be miserable anyway. So the reality is that the mind is so much more important than all these external things. So why doesn't everybody practice the development of the mind? What is the reason for that? And the main reason for that, as I can see it, is we have this sense of self inside. The sense of self gives us a feeling that we are who we are. And because we are who we are, we're not really able to understand the potential for change that there is inside of the mind. We are blinded, we are blocked by the thing inside of us that we see, the sense of self, this illusion of a self. We are blinded by this to thinking that we cannot actually go so far with developing the mind. And that's why we tend to, I think, of not put in as much effort as we otherwise might do. And it's a bit, to give you the example, it's a bit like somebody, this is from Ajahn Brahm's book, Opening Door of Your Heart, a bit like somebody, no, that's not the right simile I want to use. It's just as if somebody is very depressed, and they feel down, and after a while they feel there is no hope anymore. They feel, this is the way it is, I'm depressed. And they think, maybe the only way out of this is to commit suicide, because this life is not worth living anymore. Why is it that somebody commits suicide when they're depressed? It's because there's no hope, because they think that this condition is permanent. They think that this is who they are this depressed thing, and the only way to get out of it is by committing suicide. There's a sense of self again. There's this illusion of a self which blinds you to think that things are much more permanent than they actually are. But of course, depression is not permanent. Eventually, if you keep going, you will get out of that depression. And that's why one of the most important things to remind somebody who is depressed is to tell them, this is impermanent. This will change. This is not who you are. eventually, if you just keep holding out, keep doing the right thing, you will get out of this. And I think everybody probably has had times in their lives that have been difficult. And most people probably had times when they felt a bit depressed or down or sad. And we know that these things end. This is just the way things are. So again, we should remind ourselves that the mind is impermanent. The way we are, the way we look at the world, everything can change. So when we think about developing the mind, there is no limit to our development of mind. There is no end to it. You can achieve states of happiness and bliss beyond your imagination, beyond what you think is possible. And on the way, you will change. You will become a different, slightly different person. Your outlook will change. You will look at the world in a different way, just as you look at the world in a different way when you're happy compared to when you are sad. So remind yourself of this. Remind yourself of the great potential for spiritual development. Don't allow yourself to be blinded by this illusion that we all carry around with us. It's a terrible illusion because it stops us often from being able to enjoy this spiritual path to its maximum. Remind yourself that things are much more changeable than you think they are. And then you can start this path of mental development and go it much further, much faster than otherwise you might be able to. Okay, so that is the talk this evening here. Anybody has any questions or comments, anything you want to say about this tonight? Yes? Okay, yeah, I think, I don't know why this monk left. I spoke to him and I think he, you know, there's many reasons. I don't think he was negative or anything like that. I think his practice was going okay. He just wanted to leave. I wasn't really intending to sort of pass any judgment on that monk, but it just makes me think about the whole idea of leaving when somebody leaves. That's really all I meant by that. Yeah. So, anybody else has anything they want to ask about? Any questions? Any comments? Anybody? Yeah. Yes, sir.
Excuse me, for us lay people, and we might have to live in society, do you think that difficult circumstances can also be good teachers for us?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, this is an extremely important point, you know, and this is also, not only is it in lay life, it's also in monastic life. Sometimes monastic life can be difficult as well, you know, sometimes people think that monastic life is something completely different from lay life, but it's just, it's basically the same. It's just that monastic life is a slightly different emphasis, but you still have the same problems, you know, the same kind of things, the same hindrances that you're battling with. So essentially, it's just a microcosm of what's happening in the larger society in monastic life. But sure, of course, and this is the thing, that when you come across something difficult in life, something which is hard, sometimes it is right maybe to move away from that, to go away. But very often, the best thing to do when you have a hard time is to ask yourself, well, why is it so difficult? How can I look at things differently? How can I change myself? What can I do to actually overcome this problem? Because the problem is usually inside ourselves. If we have somebody, very often problems in life are personal problems with other people. People that upset us, make us, you know, we find very difficult to deal with, maybe bullies, I don't know what. And of course, this, instead of running away from that, is a chance to actually look at the problem differently. Because wherever you go in life, if you go somewhere else, you're always going to encounter difficult people. There's no such thing as a place, as a paradise, where nobody's difficult. This is just the way the world is. So by changing, instead of changing where you are, change your perception instead, change your mind. Because if you're able to change your mind, you deal with the problem once and for all, and you don't have it again in the future. And this is what I sometimes, I do that in monastic, I try to do exactly the same in monastic life. I look, first of all, I look at the long term and I see, okay, I seem to be making progress in monastic life, so I'll just stay here at Bodhidharma Monastery, at least for now, because it seems to be the right thing for me to do. And then a difficulty comes up, and then I try to do exactly that. I say to myself, okay, this is a difficulty. This is no reason to run away. This is a chance for me to see if I can get rid of some of my own defilements. I can weaken some of my own defilements. Try to have more compassion on the people around me. Understand that if somebody is difficult out there, there is a reason for that difficulty. They are probably suffering. They have a hard time. I should have compassion for them. I should have loving kindness for these people. How can I develop loving kindness and compassion for somebody who's difficult? How can I look at them in a different way? What is the right perception in this case? Very often we are trapped in certain ways of looking at the world. And that is one of the problems in life. We have to somehow try to get out of those traps. Try to get out. There's always the same person who always gives us the same problem. It's a trap. It's because our mind is like one track. We can't get out of it. So we have to change these tracks. We have to change these habits and try to get out of those things. So yes, I agree with you. It's problem is always a great chance for spiritual progress in life. So try the best of your ability to change it that way. If you can't, there's also nothing wrong with, there's nothing wrong either with changing your position or changing your job or whatever if you find it very hard. If it gets too much, that can also be the right thing sometimes. There's never any absolute right or any absolute wrong in this. Okay. Anybody else anything to say before we close? Yes, sir. Yeah. That's part of the thing. I mean, the more developed the mind is, the less self usually you have in there. Because usually, if the mind is less developed, it's usually more selfish, more self-centered, all these kind of things. The more developed you are, the more generous you're going to be, and the more kind you're going to be to people around you. You're going to be naturally less self-centered. There's going to be less sense of self there. But even if you are being virtuous, even if you do develop the mind, it's only when you actually make a really profound breakthrough to profound wisdom that you get through this idea of self altogether. Until you get to that point, there's always going to be a sense that there's somebody in here who is you, something permanent, a core. So because of that, there's always going to be a sense that of a limitation in there because of that sense of self. So it's always going to be with you until you get very, very far away, a long way on the spiritual path. 73. To them. Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivadim Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammam Namassami Svakato Bhagavato Asavaka Sangho Sangham Namami.